We're not gonna go to war, no. We're not gonna go to war. Today from California, yeah. Those on the hill who lack the vision, subjecting themselves to activism, hacktivism, coming page by page, sending all the net through the underground airwaves. Rise up and speak your mind, tired of the grind and kissing others behind. Find the maker to the enemy line, sign the name on a petition, listen, wishing to hear fact, not fiction. It's a mission, you need to yell with conviction. We're not gonna go to war, nah. We're not gonna go to war, because lying, cheating, stealing, robbing and killing ain't what I'm here for. We're not gonna go to war, no. We're not gonna go to war. Women and kids in the name of oil. Boil over on the floor. You got what you need, but you want much more. Whore, working the streets, counting the tricks. You're turning pride beneath the dirty sheets. See where we see what we want us to see, and how you want us to be, how you want us to be. Taking the freedom from the land of the free, necessary for our own safety. Be all that I can be. Marching up and down on the city streets, yelling, we're not gonna go to war. We're not gonna go to war, because lying, cheating, stealing, robbing and killing ain't what I'm here for. We're not gonna go to war. We're not gonna go to war.
Returning to great speeches and interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Playing with Stereotypes. Where do stereotypes come from? Why do some stereotypes persist? In this program, TED speakers examine the consequences of stereotypes. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM if you're in the Sacramento area, or you can listen to it from accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
You asked this rhetorical question early on in the poem, who controls articulation?
Mm-hmm.
Who do we think controls it?
I think that we think that language is something neutral and not at all political. I don't think we think too much about who controls language. But I do think that if you did bring the question up, most people would point to the education system in some way, right? The idea that the values and everything that governs what is allowed in that space reflects so heavily white middle class values. Hmm. So if you have mastered standard English, I think that's usually very smoothly connected to your intellectual capacity and your worth.
When someone who's not your race, right, when they look at you, do you feel like they're making specific judgments about the kind of person you are?
Most definitely, all the time. Like Du Bois speaks about this double consciousness. You have this lens where you're looking at yourself through the lens of other people, the way that they look at you. That's deeply historical in the Black community.
So it's almost like the stereotype becomes the way you start to view yourself.
It's not that you view yourself that way. I think that there's a tension. I think there's a tension with fighting to not internalize some of what has been placed on you, especially during very important formative years. At a very young age, I knew that at some point I needed to straighten my hair because it was the way to be accepted. And I never questioned it. It was just something that we did. And if you didn't straighten it again, it would just be like straight hair, but then the roots were kinky. And you would get teased by the boys. It was like really, it was something to be deeply ashamed of at the time.
And your community was primarily African-American, right?
Yep. Like, your roots are showing was something that was literally said, right? And so even now, I still feel a little tiny discomfort because it's like, just the pun on the word roots.
Yeah.
That was scarring. I felt like after a while, as I grew older and my consciousness evolved, I chose to not perm my hair anymore.
It was like a stereotype that was internalized within your own community.
Right, which is why I feel the same way when I'm forced to speak a certain way and denounce the other ways of navigating language that come from the cultural and racial spaces in my life.
I mean, that's the thing about stereotypes, is that it sort of applies this collective idea to a community or a culture or a race or a religion or a group of people. And once you're in that collective, it's like you're trapped. You have to constantly fight against it to disprove it. And yet at the same time, you don't want to appear as if you're not part of the collective and loyal to it and reflect it in positive ways as well.
Yeah, that's the tension. One of my favorite authors and scholars, Gugi Wa-Tiong'o, he wrote a book called Moving the Center. And it's informed my work in a lot of ways and thinking about a human center, but then how we go about being okay with and sure with building up our own respective centers, the spaces that make us who we are, affirming those spaces and celebrating and engaging the value of those spaces in the service of adding value to humanity. Because what happens when people feel like they have to erase themselves in order to become a part of some mysterious whole is that we rob each other of the beauty of our differences. And that's just tragic.
That's poet and scholar Jamila Liscott. To watch her entire poem, Broken English, go to ted.npr.org. So up to this point, we've been hearing about stereotypes, how we all make judgments about people based on how they look or talk. And the assumption is that these things are all bad.
I think that's an understandable conclusion, but it's not right.
This is Paul Bloom. He teaches psychology at Yale.
And I think that if you think of stereotypes as a flaw in our mind, some sort of pathology or cruelty, you actually won't understand them very well. You won't know how to combat them.
Paul studies human behavior, in particular, why we all make quick judgments about other people.
You know, you don't ask a toddler for directions. You don't ask a very old person to help you move a sofa. And that's because you stereotype. Now, stereotypes then go awry in all sorts of ways, and they cause horrible moral problems and horrible rational problems. But this is because a system that has been evolved to make generalizations in certain circumstances can go wrong in other circumstances.
So when Paul explored these ideas on the TED stage, he explained how the mind does this.
So you look at me, you know my name, you know certain facts about me, and you can make certain judgments. You could make guesses about my ethnicity, my political affiliation, my religious beliefs.
And the thing is, these judgments tend to be accurate. We're very good at this sort of thing. And we're very good at this sort of thing because our ability to stereotype people is not some sort of arbitrary quirk of the mind, but rather it's a specific instance of a more general process, which is that we have experience with things and people in the world that fall into categories, and we could use our experience to make generalizations about novel instances of these categories. So everybody here has a lot of experience with chairs and apples and dogs. And based on this, you could see these unfamiliar examples, and you could guess, you could sit on a chair, you could eat the apple, the dog will bark. Now, we might be wrong. The chair could collapse if you sit on it, the apple might be poisoned, the dog might not bark. But for the most part, we're good at this. For the most part, we make good guesses, both in a social domain and a non-social domain. And if we weren't able to do so, if we weren't able to make guesses about new instances that we encounter, we wouldn't survive.
What assumptions do we make, like, pretty much right away when we encounter somebody?
The big three that social psychologists talk about are age, sex, and race. So when you look at somebody in a fraction of a second, you record a kid, an adult, an old person, man, woman, Chinese, American, black, white, whatever. You do this in a fraction of a second. It's unconscious. It's very powerful. And those generalizations show up as early as you can test them. So babies like to hear their own language over other languages. They like to look at faces that are familiar over those that are unfamiliar, and actually like to look at familiar races over unfamiliar races. So a white baby raised by white people prefers to look at white faces than black faces, though it's not the baby's own race. So if the baby's white but raised by a multi-ethnic bunch, the baby will show no preferences.
Okay, so I mean, I get age, I get gender, but why are we wired to see race so differently when, I mean, didn't we all look the same in East Africa like 40,000 years ago?
I think that's an excellent point. And I mentioned the three generalizations, sex and age and race. But a lot of evolutionary theorists pointed out that race is the odd man out for the reasons that you pointed out. Sex and age are always going to be relevant for any primate. But race is a novelty. It's a modern thing that's emerged only in recent history. And so our focus on race then is less determined than our focus on sex and age. And this fits very nicely with the data from children. So there's no experiment has ever found that children don't care about sex and age when making decisions. They're always sensitive to it. But when kids pay attention to race, it's not because they're biologically built to be intuitive racists, but rather it's because they've learned that race matters in the world we live in.
And Paul says the problem is that racial stereotypes are often flat out wrong.
There was a fascinating study prior to the 2008 election where social psychologists looked at the extent to which the candidates were associated with America, as in an unconscious association with the American flag. And in one of their studies, they compared Obama and McCain, and they found McCain is more thought of as more American than Obama. And to some extent, people aren't that surprised by hearing that. McCain is a celebrated war hero, and many people would explicitly say he has more of an American story than Obama. But they also compared Obama to British Prime Minister Tony Blair. And they found that Blair was also thought of as more American than Obama, even though subjects explicitly understood he's not American at all. But they were responding, of course, to the color of his skin.
That is amazing to me that people would say that. And you think about it and you think, well, I wouldn't say that. But then you think, well, maybe I would.
So that's right. So there's so many social psychology experiments showing, and this is really the pernicious side of stereotypes, that even in cases where we know a stereotype doesn't apply, or we know it's mistaken, we're guided by it anyway. And these are done, for the most part, I think, by well-intentioned people who would never dream that they'd be racist. But we are influenced by factors we don't know about.
You know, earlier Jamila Liskow was talking about language as a conveyor of stereotypes, right? And about how being called articulate, for example, is a code.
Yes, I think Joe Biden slipped up and called Obama articulate in the primaries.
Yeah, I mean, this has real world consequences. I mean, this is a real thing that happens everywhere, all the time, every day, every second of the day.
It's as if you called an elderly relative lucid. You know, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So you're right. The language often reveals your expectations. To call somebody articulate is in some way reflecting the intuition that this is a surprising fact.
Yeah.
Or to say somebody's clean or composed or, you know, non-aggressive it would be an odd thing to say unless you believe there was some reason to believe that they weren't.
So now that we know about this, how do we combat it? And there are different avenues. One avenue is to appeal to people's emotional responses, to be appeal to people's empathy. And we often do that through stories. Stories can turn anonymous strangers into people who matter. And the idea that we care about people when we focus on them as individuals is an idea which has shown up across history. Psychologists have explored this. For instance, in one study, people were given a list of facts about a crisis, and it was seen how much they would donate. And another group was given no facts at all, but they were told about an individual and given a name and given a face. And it turns out that they gave far more. It's possible that by extending our sympathies to an individual, they can spread to the group that the individual belongs to.
I mean, it's like a case for making a conscious choice and decision to reach out to people who are different from you.
It really is. So you can't change implicit biases by just sitting in your room and concentrating and saying, I'm not going to be racist. But what you can do is you could actively expose yourself to real-world instances which give you maybe a more accurate and more fair representation of these groups.
I think prejudice and bias illustrate the fundamental duality of human nature. We have gut feelings, instincts, emotions, and they affect our judgments and our actions for good and for evil. But we are also capable of rational deliberation and intelligent planning. And we can use these to, in some cases, accelerate and nourish our emotions, and in other cases, staunch them. And it's in this way that reason helps us create a better world. Thank you.
Paul Bloom is a professor of psychology at Yale University. He has two fascinating talks up at TED.com.
We're all alike, all know the difference between wrong and right. We all put the baby in the cradle at night. We all need love, and that's all right. We're all alike.
All right, maggots. As you may be aware, the United States government is considering getting rid of the don't ask, don't tell policy and allowing gays to serve openly in the military. I support this. Yeah. And I just want any of you good old boys out there to know that discrimination will not be tolerated. Because we in the military, first and foremost, we believe in protecting our privates. First recruit, fall in. Fighting in Afghanistan. Fearless men, both buff and tan. He could kick your butt today.
We are the men of the Queen Beret.
Brave young men, now fill our ranks. They decorate and paint the tanks.
Join the Navy, there's no way. Can't wear white past Labor Day.
Women now have heard the news. New recruits get sensible shoes. Lesbians with guns take aim.
Militia Etheridge is our name. From Iraq to Khyber Pass, you can bet I'll watch your ass.
The enemy now runs away.
Our battle cries, YMCA!
We are fierce in battle too,
just like Rosie on the View.
For our slogan we will say,
we're behind you all the way.
Men and women round the globe, battling not just homophobes, fight and die for the USA,
where they can't wed
just cause we're gay.
Jazz hands.
We're gonna scrub the voter rolls again. We're gonna throw your vote in the recycle bin. We're gonna make sure Bush and Cheney win.
just like a Wally Odell. He's got hard GLP. He doesn't care about you or me. Guys like Wally, they hold the key to the Bush League dynasty. Blackbox voting.
Kurdistan, the region of Iraq. As you know, Iraqis just approved our new constitution. And as you also know, no one knows what is in it.
But what we really care about are more rights, more freedoms, the things you take for granted, like the right to do musical theater.
So we worked up a little number, especially for you.
Three little Kurds from school are we, come from a small minority, fighting the long insurgency. Three Kurds from in Mosul.
This little Kurd's not too good at math. 1 + 1 = 22.
I'm a bit of a psychopath. Like my shoe? Anyway, like my shoe?
I got the jihad on taking baths.
And on the bath is too.
To want formation of a Kurdish sovereign nation where we'll be free for ululation.
Three little Kurds from school.
Three little Kurds from school.
My name's Halab, that's a palindrome.
I quit drinking when out alone.
Cause of the war he gets bombed at home.
That's why he goes to school.
Let's try Saddam in a hurry now.
I'd like to sit on his jury now.
Tell him he won't have to worry now.
We little Kurds aren't cruel. We only want his jewels.
Three little Kurds are very wary of what the new constitution carries.
What if it says that gays can marry?
As long as the Kurds will rule.
With these little Kurds,
that's cool.
Politicians spend all their time digging for gold. It's time we did something about it. That joke's got to go. We're not laughing anymore. We've been burned right. Raise our voice and say no more. might try to hide their names, but we all know. We're not giving up without a fight. Those that fought before us are by our side. When you see something wrong, you just got to stand up. Did something about it, that joke's got to go. It's time we did something about it, that joke's got to go.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.